from Omaha, from Douglas County, and Justice Miller Lerman will preside, so everybody give me a minute to get out of the courtroom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Justice Miller Lerman. The Chief Justice is recused on this matter. The matter is In Re Trust of Heffler, and Judge Pancona from Douglas County is joining us. Counsel may proceed. Do either counsel have questions?
No, Your Honor.
Of the process? Okay, we're good then. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kathy Trent Villam, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Heidi Shattuck, Amber Rocha, and Brock Heffler. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal, please. Your Honor, as we come to the court today, my clients come to the court today asking this court to do what the county court failed to do, and that is apply what this court has said for decades is the law of the state of Nebraska. And that is that under Nebraska statutes, inheritance taxes are to be apportioned among the beneficiaries based on the amount of benefit that they receive from the overall estate.
Before we get to that issue, is this a final appealable order?
Which order, Your Honor?
The order you're appealing from.
Well, we're appealing from the order that ultimately decided the amount of distribution. And so, yes, we are
November
appealing from a final appealable
2021 order.
The 2020, the final order that was issued by the court before we filed the notice of appeal. Yes.
There was an order entered in March of 2022. Was that correct? Maybe I had the years wrong. But the order that denied the motion for sanctions and attorney's fees, that was entered in March.
We're appealing from the order in March that ultimately determined that fees were not going to be allowed, granted or approved the distribution, all of that.
But you're not appealing that order. You're not objecting to the sanctions.
We're not objecting to the merits, but that was the final order that allowed us to take appeal. Up until that point, there weren't any final appealable orders. And
so have we completed any discrete phase of this proceeding yet?
We have. In fact, everything is completed except to the extent of getting the final ruling in this case and determining what additional expenses should be paid from the reserve that is currently being held.
So has the court ordered inheritance tax to be paid?
The court has, yes, approved the proposed distribution.
There was an application for tentative inheritance tax that was filed, and the court entered an order sustaining that tentative inheritance tax.
Right.
That was the amount.
And denying the motion for attorney fees.
Then there later was the motion for partial summary judgment that said the trust should pay the inheritance tax.
Right.
Not the individual beneficiaries of the trust. Is that correct?
Yes.
So what's the final appealable order that you're appealing?
The March order. Because at that point, Your Honor, there's nothing more to be done other than the determination as to the reserves.
Wouldn't there be a final order from the court assessing inheritance tax? When you do a petition to determine inheritance tax, isn't there typically an order that assesses the inheritance tax?
Sure. And I
has that happened?
No. No.
Does that need to happen?
For our purposes, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because everything has been resolved. The substance of everything has been resolved. We have the order in November making the determination as to how the taxes are supposed to be allocated. All of the other claims that had been asserted by the appellants have been dismissed. And
voluntarily dismissed without prejudice?
Yes.
Does that have any impact?
No.
So those are just, they're done, and so now this is the final order?
Well, and then we have the motion for attorney fees. That issue was resolved. And then we have the court basically adopting the inheritance tax calculation. And denying the motion for...
Through the partial summary judgment.
I'm sorry?
Through the partial summary judgment.
No, through the order in March. And then we also have the order denying the motion to change the reserves or to set the reserves. That was also denied.
Okay.
My understanding of the jurisdictional challenge that the appellees are alleging is that they're alleging that the November order is the order that we should have appealed from. And I think based on this court's decision in McMahon, which came after the parties completed the briefing, it's not possible for that order to have been the final appealable order.
Then why not?
Because in McMahon, the court said that even if you have a special proceeding, anytime you have a case where there are multiple parties or multiple claims, the court has to resolve all of the claims against all of the parties or make an express finding that there should be a final judgment. And regardless of what claims were or were not dismissed, there is no express finding, and claims continue to persist after that order was entered. So, for example, the dismissal of the undue influence claim came after the court entered that order. So at the time the court entered that order, those claims were still outstanding. Not only were those claims outstanding, but the outcome of those claims could have affected the resolution of the other components. Because obviously if the Third Amendment is caused by undue influence, it's not enforceable, and then that resolves some of the tax issues as well. So that dismissal came after the November order.
And that was a voluntary dismissal without prejudice?
Yes.
Does that have any impact?
No. There are cases, Your Honor, where the court has said you can't get to a final order by voluntarily dismissing something without prejudice. But in those cases, there were no other claims remaining. When those dismissals were made, there was still a motion for attorney fees pending. And this court has said that before a final judgment is entered, if there is a motion for attorney's fees pending, that motion has to be resolved before there's a final order. So after the November order, they filed a motion for attorney fees. That then prevents there from being a final judgment so long as there are other claims that are still outstanding. At that point, the undue influence claim was outstanding, the accounting claim was outstanding. The court had not made a final determination or adopted the inheritance taxes. So the November order cannot be a final order under McMahon. And I think the court went to significant lengths to make it clear that regardless of whether this was in a special proceeding and regardless of whether it was even a final order under 25-1902, you have to also have the express determination. And if you don't have that express determination, then there is no final appealable order.
And that occurred in the March order, that express determination.
I believe the March order resolved all of the claims.
And therefore, you do not need an express determination.
Right.
Under 1315, that kind of thing.
Right, because we have a final judgment at that point.
Okay, so before that, there were pieces and parts still pending that you believe made it not appropriate yet to yet appeal.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So do you want to talk about apportionment?
I would love to talk about apportionment. So back to the beginning of my opening. We're here to ask the court to do what the county court failed to do, which is determine that the statutory presumption was not overcome. And what this court has said for decades is that in order to overcome that statutory presumption, the language in the testamentary document, whether that's a will or a trust, has to be clear and it has to be unambiguous. If it's not clear, the statutory presumption applies. If it's ambiguous, then you construe the ambiguity in favor of apportionment. And what we have here is a document, a trust document, that standing alone was not clear. And then once you try to shoehorn this Third Amendment into it, creates additional ambiguities above and beyond the lack of clarity that was there.
What are the possible interpretations with regard to inheritance taxes? I hear you arguing that the trust documents are ambiguous with respect to how inheritance taxes would be handled.
Right.
What are the possible
interpretations? So the document standing alone is unclear before we even get to the Third Amendment. And it's unclear for a couple of reasons. First of all, it says pay from this trust. And this trust is the entire trust corpus. It doesn't say pay from the residue. So in most courts and other authorities say that if you want to make a clear determination or direction that you are going to overcome the apportionment, you need to do three things. First, you need to identify which of the gifts or which of the beneficiaries are going to be relieved of the burden. Then you have to identify which taxes, so are we talking estate taxes, inheritance taxes? Then you also have to identify where that burden is being shifted to. So you need to have those three elements in order to overcome that statutory presumption. What we have here is a reference to inheritance taxes, but it doesn't identify which benefits or which gifts.
It says all inheritance taxes.
It does say all inheritance taxes, but it doesn't say which of the gifts within the trust is being relieved of that tax burden. And it also doesn't say where that tax burden is going to come from. What we know is that at the time that we're looking at subpart 7A, that the residence is part of the corpus trust. It hasn't yet been resolved. And based on the way that the amendment is written, it doesn't get resolved until we get down to 7D. So what the language says and the way that this agreement is structured is you pay taxes, you pay inheritance taxes from this trust, then you pay expenses and debts, then you distribute my personal property, and then before you distribute the income and the principal, you give the house to Ms. Miller so long as she's still residing there. So the question isn't which interpretation of the language is right. The question really is the appellant's interpretation of the trust language and the amendment reasonable? Because if our interpretation is reasonable, and I submit to you that it's very reasonable, then you have an ambiguity.
And what is your interpretation? What is your interpretation that you're proffering as reasonable?
Our interpretation is that the instruction to pay taxes is simply an instruction to pay the taxes. It doesn't apportion. There's nothing in here about apportionment. When you look at the other cases where the court has said, okay, the presumption is overcome, you have a couple of things. Like, for example, the Shell case, the In Re Estate of Shell that the appellees rely on so much. That case specifically makes a reference to the residuary. Pay my expenses from my residuary. Then within the same paragraph, it says, pay the inheritance taxes without contribution or reimbursement. Court has said that's sufficient to demonstrate an intent to actually shift the tax burden. But we don't have any of that in this case. All we have is pay the taxes from the trust, which includes the residents. So, Your Honors, we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the county court and find that the taxes are to be apportioned. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Peets. I am representing Lori Miller, the appellee, and also vicariously representing the successor trustee, Robert Hessler of the Michael A. Hessler Trust, since our interests are the same. So the trustees indicated that they were not going to come to argue today.
So the time is all yours.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is this a final appealable order?
I believe that it is. Both parties filed motions for summary judgment on the issue, and I thought it was a final appealable order.
I think in Justice Funk's question, the word "this" may have been misinterpreted by you or me, perhaps. Which order or orders do you think were final orders?
Well, I think that the ruling on the order,
the
inheritance tax, November order.
You think that was a final order?
I do, Your Honor. I think for purposes of this case, that you can determine that it's a final order.
Was the March order also a final order?
I do believe the March order was the final order, but I think that the inheritance tax was determined by the previous order in November.
So your position, at least, is we have jurisdiction over an appeal from the March order, but not over
Correct.
The November order.
Correct.
And that all depends on whether the November order was or was not interlocutory.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And the March order doesn't Does it deal with the inheritance tax, or is it dealing with sanctions and reserves?
Well, the March order dealt with sanctions and reserves, but the we did not appeal the county court order of sanctions. Obviously, with the burden of proof on appeal, we gave it our best shot. We lost. Let's move on. Let's get this trust completed.
So the November order is final and should have been appealed within 30 days. Is your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is our position. But if the court wants to say that the March order becomes a final order to close the trust case, I think that there's case law that position can be sustained as well.
So, do you disagree with what I understand your opponent's position to be, that the filing of the motion for sanctions that followed within days after the November order made the November order interlocutory, at least it not subject to appeal until after the fee issue and sanction issue?
No, I do not agree with him.
Now, we have case law that has said that the pendency of sanctions does prevent something from being appealed. Right. How do you distinguish that case law?
Because the request for sanctions came after that, after the March order. It wasn't before. It wasn't
after
a pending.
After the November order, you mean?
Yeah, after the November order, excuse me. And so that's the distinction. I think we cite that in our brief.
So if the motion for sanctions had been made the day before the November order, you would agree with your opponent that it was not a final order.
Correct.
But because of the difference in the timing,
right,
that's what your argument rests on.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
We don't have in our record a petition to determine inheritance tax. Was there one filed? There's a application to determine tentative inheritance tax.
There was not.
So the matter started based on the petition for declaratory relief, removal of trustee, accounting, those undue influence, those causes of action.
Yes. Our position, I think if the court wants to hear the issue on ambiguity, is we don't think that there's an ambiguity in the trust. We think that this trust case is just similar to Shell. It's the trust version of the Shell case that this court decided in 2015. We think that the language is clear.
So what portion of the trust does this language purport to direct that taxes be paid from?
Well, it says this trust, and it's coupled. You have to look at Article 7 as a complete the article. You can't bifurcate it and say, well, this is not, there's no connectivity. I think if you look at 7A and 7B, you see the connectivity that the court relied upon when they determined Shell back in 2015. And so I believe that the trust is sufficient. And of course, case law is that the courts have to look at the trust in its entirety. And I would submit to you that it's clear from the trust. I just don't think there's an ambiguity. I think that the drafting of the trust clearly intended that the taxes be paid off the top. It's section 7A, and then you go into the dispositive or distribution provisions later on in that same Article 7. And I think it's very similar to the Shell case. It's just this is a trust, and it's an extenuation of the Shell case and the decision that the court made.
But didn't Shell talk about pay from the residue?
I think Shell said pay from the residue. But in this case, if it says it's going to be paid from the trust, that includes the whole trust. It doesn't specifically carve out the residue.
So doesn't that take us back to then apportionment?
No. No, it does not. When it says it should be paid from this trust, that's a very clear directive that comes off the top when you look at all of Article 7.
The trust consists of liquid assets and real estate.
Correct.
So how does the trustee know of the trust, where that money should come from to pay the inheritance.
Well, the trust has to look at what liquid assets there are to pay that.
Is your suggestion then that the calculation is done by the total value of the corpus?
Yes.
Regardless of its character or the character of its pieces?
Yes. Because I think when you look at the actual language in Article 7, when it talks that it couples it and it says it's distributed outright, that it talks about the real estate, that it's distributed outright to Miller sufficiently shows the decedent's intentions.
Well, the distribution doesn't inform us about the size or the composition of the trust.
Well, correct. When you're drafting a trust, you don't know I always tell my clients, there's three things I don't know. I don't know when you're going to die. I don't know what assets you're going to have. And I certainly don't know what the taxing scheme will be, federal and state, at that time. That's why we hope that people become current with their.
Is there statutory authority for the trustee to spend on liquid assets first as opposed to selling the house and putting the proceeds of the house into the trust and then using that?
I think that the trust always, I think that the administration of a trust, they're always going to look to what available assets there are. I think that's the discretion of the trust.
Well, they're all available.
Correct. But I think that's
the house is available. You could sell the house.
But I think that's a discretion. First, I think it's a discretion of the trustee. But I also think when you look at that trust and he uses the language outright, that makes a difference. I think
that's
the key provision is outright in the trust.
That's in the Fourth Amendment or Third Amendment.
Third Amendment. Okay. So the propositions of law, we're following Shell. What this is the trust version of Shell. The three propositions of law in Shell talk about to circumstance statutory inheritance apportionment. A testator may employ any word or combination of words, and a few simple words might be enough to show his or her intent when the word's outright. Language referring to estate and inheritance taxes and directing that they be paid from the residuary estate will supplant statutory authority, and courts have generally concluded that language directing the executor, and of course we have a trustee in this case, to pay estate and inheritance taxes exonerates the beneficiaries of the tax burden. When I was here before this court and argued on the previous trace, the court looked at the plain language of the trust and said, you have to follow the language of the trust. And you have to look at all the language in the trust. You can't pick out portions.
So was the house like a specific devise?
It essentially became that with the Third Amendment.
So does that take priority over the other assets of the trust? If it were in a will,
yes,
it would.
Yes.
Would it take precedent over the other assets of the trust? If it were in a will, it would.
Yeah, I agree. It essentially is a specific device, but it's a specific distribution in the trust.
So is the custom then, where there's such a designated asset, to set that aside and then go about either equalizing or raising the money for taxes?
Well, I think the custom is you pay the tax. I think you have to look at the sequence. You pay the taxes off the top, 7A and 7B. You have to look at the coupling of 7A, Section 7A and 7B, and then you see, okay, we pay these taxes.
You find you determine a certain tax liability,
yes,
right? And then you got to raise the money.
Yes.
And in the process, do you first set aside at that point a designated asset that is not liquid?
No.
So just because something is specifically devised doesn't mean that it's not subject to inheritance tax, does it?
No, it's subject to inheritance tax.
I mean, you have to, you're relying really on the apportionment clause, aren't you?
Yeah, well, the language of the trust that gets rid of the apportionment provisions.
The word outright talks, I think, about, well, Your argument is that it's both for purposes of distribution and it somehow factors into the apportionment.
Yes.
And if we disagree, that's not so good. If we agree, then you're home.
Yes.
All right.
Were there further questions? No. I think we went just a little bit over here, if you don't mind, sir. And Ms. Trent Williams, let's give you 30 seconds.
Again, this court has said it has to be clear and it can't be ambiguous. The fact that we're sitting here having this conversation, I think, shows that it's not clear and that it's ambiguous. We have an amendment that they are trying to attempt to incorporate that creates any number of problems. To your question, Your Honor, about outright is not a clear term. They're saying that it means that you get rid of the apportionment statute. Outright can also mean simply that she takes it without subject to being subject to a mortgage. So outright itself is ambiguous. It certainly doesn't clarify anything in the original trust amendment. And if you accept their initial proposition that the original intent back in 2006 was that we were going to do away with the apportionment and the estate's going to pay everything and it's all going to come out of the residue, even though the word residuary and residue appears nowhere in the entire trust agreement or any of the amendments. But even if you accept that proposition, then why would you be having outright suddenly being the outcome determinative factor of apportionment? You can't have it both ways. You can't say it was clear in the beginning and it was the intent in the beginning, and yet we added the term outright in order to overcome statutory presumption.
Thank you. I think it finishes the thought. Thank you very much. Y'all are excused.
Thank you.